Mic check, mic check. All right, good. Looks like the signal's coming through clear. Again, this is J. Quentin Blackburn, member Unit 0. Designation in Unit 0 is 6, and I'm continuing my statement for the investigators in who are looking into Incident 001.000, also known as Control-Alt-Delete-Reset. So just give me a second to check the transcript. I want to make sure I don't cover anything I've already said. Let's see. Got to the wall. People being dismembered and turned into hard augments. Dancing machines knocked us around. Doesn't look like I got to the part where we were flushed down the toilet or we were blowing up tons of machines. Oh, also didn't talk about how I got my leg crushed and removed. Nice. All right, so there's still a ways to go. So first, I have a request from the investigators to more fully explain the digital field flexures. So imagine that classic image showing a star's mass bending gravity. If you had a good science teacher, they may have thrown a heavy ball on an elastic sheet to show, you know, what it looks like when a heavy object bends space-time. Well, that layer that the ball is warping around itself is space-time, the fabric of the cosmos, reality itself. Now, in our modern context, that once smooth layer is now multiple layers of space and time, which can move independent of each other. The digital field does two things. First, it regulates the flow of time through all the layers. And second, it folds the multiple spatial layers, kind of like origami. Modern architecture is all about using this extra dimensionality created by broken space and what happens when you fold it, especially to reinforce these megastructures like the Gulf Wall. Now, in general, there are three levels to the digital field, and we call them flexes or flexures to avoid confusion, since just about every structure has levels. Also, flexure is another word for fold, and since folding space is what the Di-Fi does, it just kind of makes sense. The first flex is industrial. Lots of contamination, heavy manufacturing. It's where a lot of the poor people live, mostly non-citizens. It's usually called the floor. This is also where we operate from and live and hide out. I mean, there's not a lot of life down here outside of us and the people who can't afford to climb up. The second flex is commercial and residential. A lot of citizens and members call it, are in this area, and we call it the attic. The third flex we call the roof, and that's where power on grid is rained from. In some places, it's literally a city above the clouds. People here can skip from tower to tower top and rarely have to come down to ground level. Now, without getting too far into the weeds, one of the biggest challenges in the modern world is moving between flexes. Remember, it's not just macro space that we walk around in that's busted up. It's also micro space where things like atomic structures and the flow of electrons are controlled that have to be regulated. For those on grid, it's really not a big deal, and our hardware, it has the advantage of generally being unaffected by broken space or the Di-Fi, but for people in the static core and really anybody living primarily off-grid, that is outside of the digital field or shielded from it, we can't easily jump from one flex of the city to the other. The extent to which this is true is different for everyone, but I'm like most people. Both my internal and external medical systems have to be calibrated when I go from a lower flex to a higher flex or even from a higher flex to a lower flex. I've always got to be tuned in right. If it's not done, it's basically like walking into a microwave. Now, it's not instantly deadly and everybody responds differently to not being calibrated for the flex they're in. And that calibration can be done in a lot of ways, but it takes a ton of energy. The most common solution used by the core is a sync hub. basically a big magnetic field generator and med systems interface that retunes you for the flex that you're going into. They're common at code enforcement offices and other static facilities like workshop codexes, offices, basically anywhere where people are going to be coming and going and need to pass through. Okay, so here we are, still in the first flex, on the floor, fighting in the wall. So at this point, we were riding those big retrieval droids deep into the guts of the wall. Monitoring the air is a primary concern since, you know, not breathing would kind of put a damper on our rescue op. I knew we had extra air cans because we always carry extra of everything. We live by the overpack rule. Always take more, whatever you need. Between the extra air cans and the air cans that are built into the suit, we had enough air for weeks. But what really worried me was my suit being compromised. That's the common cause of death or maiming in the core. Now, it's not enough to monitor the air concentration. You also have to actually know what's in the atmosphere. I mean, if your mitigating layers or your gas mask filters or equipment doesn't work or needs to be adjusted, you got to make sure you're not breathing in anything that's toxic or that doesn't have a smell. You also want to check and make sure that there's nothing flammable in the atmosphere. That's another old trick they use on grid for security. They pump a room full of methane or some other flammable gas and flash burn the room. Sure enough, by the time we got down to the machine shops, there was no breathable air. The security was also at a higher level, so we couldn't risk touching any of the machines and putting them in offensive mode. We had to get on foot and hike the last 2 miles or so to get to the distress call, and it was down a long corridor which paralleled the machine shops and manufacturing lines for the lower sections of the wall. Every once in a while, we had to hug the wall to keep from getting run over by a machine. Moving through these spaces is dangerous, but it's actually easy if you do it right. Traveling in these machine lines is generally about timing. Most of these corridors are the size of a 2-lane road, so machines can travel in both directions. Moving along the sides, there are usually turnout shoulders, which are designed for the machines to have space to pull over, just in case something larger needs to get by. These turnouts are irregularly spaced, though. Luckily, the route we're on just happened to be not very busy at the time, because, I mean, sometimes these places can be backed up bumper to bumper like traffic. I had to keep track of what was coming in both directions, where the next duck-off space would be in case we needed to get out of the way, and I had to drive the pace of the march and keep everybody on time so nobody would get stuck and crushed against the wall. As crazy as all that sounds, it was a relatively easy trek. Not like the way we came down earlier, where we had to descend down vertical shafts and crawl along pipes and walk along the edge of some pretty deep crevasses. When we finally got to where the distress signal from Unit 675 was coming from, there were problems. Primarily, no one was there. Or there wasn't where it was when they first started sending the distress signal, might be a better way to say it. First, like any other radio signal, static signals degrade over distance. If the signal had been strong, we would have also gotten the dimensional coordinates with it and would have been able to know that its true point of origin was different from the source where we were picking it up at the time. Now, this is another thing that's in my top three of most hated, but the other problem we had at that moment was that the static signal had been fractured. Where we were, deep in the bowels of the Gulf Wall, used to be part of some other structure. When the space got divided and moved, the signal stayed with it. At the very least, we were able to figure out the point of origin, and that was the Miami Cityplex. That answers a question the investigators had later about how we ended up at the Tardata Tech headquarters in the Miami Cityplex. We went where the beacon came from. Now, luckily, we did have a way out. There was a bathroom hidden in one of the turnoff shoulders, and it had an extra large toilet. Now, in this case, a toilet is not a place to relieve yourself. And it was also not a matter of luck as to why the beacon was placed near here. It was a matter of training. Whenever possible, place your emergency beacon at or near points of entry. Unit 675 did exactly what they were trained to do. Now, if you ever find yourself in a room with a large pipe sticking straight out of the floor, consider yourself lucky. By the way, I've got $1,000 for anybody who can tell me why this thing is painted bright green. Word of caution when using these pipes. Always check your signal searcher to find out where it goes. One of the downside of things built by the infection protocol is that sometimes the routes go nowhere. They can drop you off in a place that's more dangerous than where you left. I mean, it's a crapshoot. Usually toilet pipes run to some sort of sewage treatment facility. In this case, the wall had a huge reservoir that ran its entire length, so it was a good news, bad news situation. Good news being we would have a clear path back to the head of the wall. Bad news being that we would have to swim through a river of toxic waste and chemical runoff to get there. Now, I don't know if it's my OCD or my training or having been burned a time or two by not checking the seals on my suit, but that's what I did, and I asked everyone else to do the same before moving forward. Now, one improvement that has come along since we were in the freezer, as soon as I climbed up on the pipe and went to go inside, I actually got a reminder in my heads-up display to check the seals on my suit. So, hats off to whoever put that in. Again, this is not just a regular pipe. It's 8 feet around, and inside is a track with a car big enough for two, and it's powered by an electric motor. Pharaoh sent his standard droids first to make sure we weren't falling into a death trap. They would also bring up the rear just in case something happened to come up behind us. When you're on grid, there is never a moment to relax. That pipe ride was about 10 minutes to get us from where we were to the nearest drop-off point. It's not the pitch black that's scary when wading through these reservoirs. Even without light, we use different ways to see. Some of them are individual, and some of them we use in our heads-up display that's shared among the group. I mean, we've got sonar, radar, LIDAR, basically any kind of DAR you can think of, infrared, ultraviolet. Walking through water, though, it's nearly impossible to mask your location, so we knew we were going to get tracked. Two of the droids at the rear went down to gunfire coming off drones that had polymorphic surfaces. They masked themselves from all those aforementioned DARs and scans by constantly shifting the dimensions and compositions of their exteriors. It's great camouflage, but fragile. The drones are a little bit bigger than a basketball, so not hard to shoot. The key is actually not taking them all down, though. If we had blown them all up as fast as possible, they would have sent a wave of 10, and then 20, and then 50. As long as we let two or three survive, it was manageable. We just had to keep watch on our backs as we climbed over the retainer walls that ran across the reservoir every few hundred yards. Now, this does come with the risk of continuing to be shot at, but their rounds are a minimal threat. 99% of guns on grid are rail guns that use magnetic acceleration, since chemicals can be too unstable. One of our older pieces of tech is a magnetic pulse disruptor shield. Yeah, it's a mouthful. It destabilizes the rounds and slows them down, so they're less effective at close range. And I mean, even our layers of armor help protect us, but you know, we always believe in doubling up on everything. Word to the wise: check the Doom Trooper's guide to see what kind of rounds or weapons your enemies use. Even the magnetic shield has to be calibrated appropriately. And if you're going up against somebody that likes to use exotic guns, that 1% of exotic guns is enough to end your tour of duty permanently. We kept up the game of cat and mouse with the drones until we got to the end of the reservoir. There was a literal light at the end of the tunnel. When we climbed over the last retaining wall, we held perfectly still. The last couple of drones that were looking for us buzzed around trying to get a lock, but since we were perfectly silent at that point, they couldn't find us. We were about 200 yards from the edge, from a ledge that looked above the work zone. Overhead, cranes and hovercraft maneuvered blocks the size of large houses and office buildings into place. We had assumed that all the people working on this end of the wall had been turned into hard augments, but down in some of the sections, I could see groups of people just working. Some of them were directly beneath a stone and actually kind of guiding it into place. I'll provide a separate autopsy report to better explain exactly how these people both escaped the static and the digital field scans. But the gist of it was they were reading as part of the wall. That's when Pharaoh shared his read on the digital field in our heads-up display. He was still able to access and delineate all the signals moving through the grid. He zoomed in on that group of people. It was about 400 positioning the foundation stone. The signals they were pumping into them were 10 to 20 times more powerful than anything that was allowed. They were running so much juice into those people, their internal medical systems and whatever other augments they had hooked into them were all lit up like Christmas trees. They were flying. Then we saw this flying tanker hover in and get close and start spraying everybody under there with some kind of foam. Pharaoh made the Di-Fi signals visual and highlighted a particular series of codes as they were being transmitted to the people in the pit. A few minutes later, the wailing began, moments before the people started melting. It didn't take long before it went silent, and the last thing they did was send in some robot to skim the remains for any implants or augments that were left behind after the people were turned into sludge. There's really nothing that can be said after seeing hundreds of living people turned into glue, into mortar, to hold the bricks of this wall together. The crane holding the block lowered it the final few feet, and that was the end of it. More people marched in, more blocks were coming in, and at that moment, I began to see the wall as less of a piece of infrastructure and more as a massive graveyard. Pharaoh showed us something else. The same 400 people that were just killed under the block were still visible on grid as being alive. Somehow their IMS were being kept active. Pharaoh shared a data file with us that marked every instance where the codes that were sent to melt the people down had been used, and he kept track of every person that was showing as alive but was actually turned into mortar. It turned out many of the millions of people that were supposed to be working on the Gulf Gate State Barrier had actually been turned into the Gulf Gate State Barrier. As gruesome as this revelation was, it didn't do a lot to change the context of our immediate mission. We were still there on a rescue op. It did, however, make it clear that both Tardata and Versal Services were violating the Brick Wars compact that they signed with the Static Core. Versal was one of the first companies to fully commodify a person, but they weren't the only one. And they're actually how they came to power was by turning people into commodities. Decades ago, sovereign corporations would just work people to death and then press their remains into bricks to be used for construction or other needs. Then some genius said, "Hey, why wait till the people die?" This was seen as a boon for efficiency, since productivity of workers declines as they get closer to death. And the list of reasons for using biologically based materials in modern construction and manufacturing is actually long and compelling, according to some. But there are a myriad of solutions that are better than melting and bricking people. However, none of them are cheaper. This all happened decades before I was defrosted, but when the Corps found out the companies were killing people to use them as building materials, the first move was to try and get the Extra National Society to make bricking people a code violation. They refused to do so under the premise that one might choose to do such a thing of their own free will. After that, the Corps went on a scorched earth campaign to destroy every company involved. Only two of them survived. It was long and ugly guerrilla warfare that lasted nearly 20 years and saw dozens of towns and cities go up in smoke. Tens of thousands of digits died. Millions of non-citizens died. Things finally came to a head when two units, 303 and 9, teamed up, carved a path of destruction 75 miles long through New York City, and held the attendees of the Builders Alliance meeting hostage. They didn't start negotiations until after they turned five people into the top five selling products right there in front of everyone. A lot of respect is due to them. Grave Raiser's Gambit is still required reading and study for new recruits, so you'll learn about the brick wars and how they ended. But the compact was very straightforward. The sovereign corporations agreed to stop bricking the living, and we agreed to stop the random destruction of their homes, businesses, and any structure built using people who had been killed solely for the purpose of using them as a commodity. Complaint here. There was a clear failure by core leadership to uphold the terms of the Human Commodities Conflict Compact. It was evident from the earliest report of the wall's progress that people were being killed for its construction. The failure to respond appropriately led to more deaths of non-citizens than was necessary, and to the deaths and maimings of dozens of Corps members who actually sought to solve this problem. If Corps leadership had done what they were supposed to do when they first found out people were being bricked, then we wouldn't have had to have blown up the wall when it became the monster that it turned into. The compact has immediately enforceable terms, chiefly that any equipment or products used in or created by human commodifications shall be destroyed on site. And when such actions take place, no offensive or defensive measures may be employed by those found in violation of the compact. A special communication was set up, and to my knowledge, it was never used until just the other day. At least for a little while, things got real simple. Pharaoh called over one of the hover barges that ferry equipment down to the wall. Hopping on, we strapped ourselves down, pulled out the big guns, and started taking stock of potential targets. Hi-Rez shared the catalog of machines he'd been building to our group hub. Pharaoh jumped into the show and brought up a detailed spec list for some specific machines that were weaponized, and highlighted the control units, which had no human pilots, and any other machines that could be destroyed without killing a person. Pharaoh put a bounty on the control units. We matched them at $5,000 apiece, and just to make it a little bit of fun, made it winner take all. Shutting down the work at the head of the wall was the first step in destroying it. Now, to be clear, at this point, we didn't have a fully formed plan. At the moment, it was about retribution and causing chaos, just shutting the work down. We spent about 20 minutes flying around, surveying the area, seeing how the work lines moved, and just kind of taking stock of the whole deal. It's not enough to just take out the bots, relaying the signals from the digital field to the basic worker drones. The AIs would just find a workaround. Chain fed, 4-barrel, 50 cal Gatling guns, even though they're mounted on swing arms onto our back and made with lightweight materials, they're still hefty. But man, do they sing. At least the spinning barrels do. The trigger pull starts a drumbeat when the rounds start going off. Firing short bursts, we started by taking down the heavy lifting elevators that carry large dump trucks down the wall to the construction floor. When the repair drones started streaming out, we took those down with crippler rounds that didn't destroy them since they had human pilots. Swooping back around into the pit, our long strafing runs lit up the bots and lines like fireworks on a string. Dade scanned the sky for tanker drones and peppered them with shots. He was particularly meticulous, blowing out the power plants in their underbellies as soon as they got off the ground from the refilling stations with whatever chemical foam they were using to spray on people. We took turns blowing up the tankers as they sat right next to the chemical plants that dotted the work pit floor. At first, the attack would just cause the work to shift around. But the more of the command units we took out, the more disorganized things got. Flying just above the heads of the machines, I pulled out my cricket bat and started taking swings. At first, I just wanted to smash the heads of some of these drones to pieces. And then I figured out if I hit them just right, with a little bit of a scoop motion, I could knock their heads clean off whole and send them flying into the air. The other guys started picking them off like they were shooting clay pigeons. Now, for all that talk about brick war compacts and what's not supposed to happen, we got blown out of the sky. No doubt Versal or Tardata they're probably just saying that they didn't get any signal or they didn't violate the compact. But at that moment, none of that really matters when you're hurtling towards the ground. The airspace started clearing and Farrell told us the signals on the digital field were going live, meaning that either a real person or a higher level AI was taking control of the grid in that area. As soon as we hit the ground, we sent up a distress call and immediately got a response saying that rescue was en route. That's what's supposed to happen when someone in the core calls for help. That's when we also got targeted. Always keep an eye on your heads up display and make sure you pick something you'll notice as an indicator for when you've been hit with a target lock. Now, they only had us with a proximity lock, so that gives them accuracy within about 20 feet, but that's not a lot of room to work in when the enemy can paint the ground in bullets. Weapons fire started pouring in. The hail of tracer rounds come in long straight lines of 5-round bursts, but when they get closer, our mag shielding causes them to arc away, making it look like we're surrounded by sparks. The machines around us quickly turned and started moving in on our position. Some of them were being controlled by that live digital field signal, and they were keying right in on us. We were able to use the wreckage from the barge as cover, but our rescue was 15 minutes out. That's an eternity when you're being shot at. Holstering the Gatling guns on our backs, we opted for smaller arms, shotguns and assault rifles. Our priority was to make some defensive lines out of the machines we were crippling or destroying. The extra droids Farrell was controlling came in handy as gophers to move around the wreckage as we made it. Again, this is where teamwork counts. Pharaoh, Hyrez, and Law hung back, using rifle fire to beat back the mounting horde. Me and Dade, using shotguns, moved around among the machines, delivering finishing shots and incapacitating the bigger bots by blasting their legs or wheels, leaving them lame for the other guys to polish off. Things were going pretty well till we saw the armored crates being drop-shipped by flying drones. We knew, as soon as we saw them, things were gonna get ugly. This is Javon, creator and current voice of Static Core. I want to say thank you for listening. I've worked on this story for the better part of 20 years, and to finally have a way to get it out to the public is really exciting to see that people are actually listening to it and becoming fans. My ultimate vision for Static Core has always been that it would be a multimedia experience, and that at its height, it would be an integrated anime and video game. And what that means is that as this story continues to get told in this podcast, in a comic book, and hopefully in the not too distant future in that animated series, that then the video game comes out and it gives fans an opportunity to be their own digit, build their own unit, have their own base, and have their own adventures, things that I could never script or imagine. That when season 2 or season 3 finally drops and you turn on Netflix and you sit down to watch that season premiere, the stories that have unfolded and the adventures that became a part of the video game actually then become a part of the animated series and take the story into places and in directions I never would have thought of. You can make that happen just by continuing to listen, but more importantly, by sharing this podcast with a friend or family member. If you know somebody that loves podcasts and books on tape, send it to them and tell them why you're listening. If you know somebody that's never listened to a podcast or a book on tape, send it to them too and say, hey, you should check this out. Maybe they'll fall in love with Static, and or maybe this will just get them hooked onto listening to podcasts like I do. But thank you for being a part of the Static Core. And that's what I've always wanted, is to have a story that fans could love and participate in and could really feel was not just something, a story that was being told to them, but a story that they would have a hand in telling. On a personal note, whatever your dream is, chase it down and make it a reality, whether it's something big and world-changing or something that's just going to make your life better on a day-to-day basis. Live your dream. Life is too short to do anything else. Thanks, and tune in next time for a new episode.